Hello again.
I want to jump in on that last question, if you don't mind. So if we would accept part of your argument and say that there needs to be some type of review of the effectiveness of trial counsel, but we didn't adopt a Strickland standard in the procedures that you were advocating here today, but did something more along the lines of what we do in the TPR cases, how would the public defender's office, do you envision, deal with that? Do you think you'd still have to have a separate unit then reviewing that particular issue with respect to the appeal, or would there have to be a separate appellate unit then in within the SVP arena?
I think that's a great question, and it's a difficult one to answer. I think part of the inherent difficulty in applying the same test from TPR is that it does have to be on the record, and it is quite a low standard. And if that's the case, there won't be any challenges to the effectiveness of appellate counsel. And in this case, I think is a perfect example of how I am also fallible. And I have made an error in this case. I didn't cite a specific statute in the point relied on in the initial brief, and I should have, and I know better. It has to do with the admissibility of expert testimony, which is a rule I know well, and I've talked to this court about numerous times, and I failed to do it, and I have no reason why I failed to do it. So if we are applying the TPR standards, if this court were to find that my client, Mr. Brady, is not able to get relief because of my failure, then what is left for him? How would he be able to challenge the ineffectiveness of appellate counsel, which he is both statutorily entitled to under the SVPA, and I have argued that he is entitled to under the Constitution as well? So that's a question that I don't have a great answer to, other than to say I think it would be ineffective, and I think it would be a very difficult thing to try to pursue on direct appeal. I'm not sure how some other attorney could also be involved in this direct appeal while challenging me and challenging trial counsel, and we would present one appeal to the court. It does seem inherently like that needs to be two different procedures or two different mechanisms.
Is there a record made, at what point do you attach as counsel to the defendant, and can aspects of that representation lead to an ineffective assistance claim that would not be on the record? Is there a concern that...
Sure. Me personally as appellate counsel?
No, the trial counsel, I'm sorry.
The trial counsel. So this court has said that the due process rights counsel attaches when the Attorney General's office files the petition. Typically, we see that happen somewhere between 3 months and a couple of weeks before someone is released from prison. It is before the probable cause hearing. And if the rights counsel attaches at that point, then there are certainly things that could or could not happen that wouldn't be apparent from the record. So, for example, in another case that I'm currently working on an appeal, there was an expert opinion that the client did not meet any of the SVP criteria. However, that opinion was not presented at trial, and there was no expert defense presented at trial. I know that because I have access to the trial counsel's file, and not because anything appeared on the record.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I think in the interim, while this court mulls about perhaps a new rule that would apply to SVPs or not, we do need to know in one of these two cases how it is that we should be litigating ineffective assistance of counsel claims for the time being. Judge Sisler's right. I raised them on direct appeal for fear that we would somehow lose the ability to raise them at all. If habeas is the avenue this court thinks is appropriate, I need to know that so that I know how to represent the men who have been civilly committed. There are some other issues in Mr. Brady's case that I'd like to talk about as well, if there are no other questions about raising and litigating ineffective assistance of counsel claims. And I guess I would also say to Ms. Stolen's suggestion that there aren't a lot of cases about the due process rights counsel. Initially, the United States Supreme Court evaluated all rights counsel cases under the 14th Amendment, cases like Powell versus Alabama, Avery, McMahon, and Strickland cited to those. Strickland relied on cases interpreting the 14th Amendment due process clause right to counsel. And cases like Chapman and Jenkins, the SVP cases from Virginia and South Carolina, have done extensive research and detailed them out in their opinions, demonstrating that nearly every court that has addressed civil commitment and effective assistance of counsel claims has done so under Strickland because of the massive deprivation of liberty at stake. In this case, there are several instances of ineffective assistance of counsel that Mr. Brady received. One of which was failure to file a motion for new trial in time. In the event this court sides with the Southern District and believes that the motion for new trial was untimely and the court could not permit an extension of 10 days, that's another example of ineffective assistance of counsel as it relates to the motion for new trial and the efficacy of trying to preserve these things below. Not only would ineffective assistance not been in the motion for new trial, it would render all ineffective assistance claims unreviewable on appeal. In this case, if the court were to side with the Southern District, and we would ask for plain error review to apply to the remaining claims if the court were to find that error as well. But excuse me, just a moment. I would like to talk about the last point in Mr. Brady's brief, which relates to juror number 4 and his responses during voir dire. The issue is relatively simple and straightforward, but it has an impact on every case in Missouri that goes to trial, beyond just this case and beyond just SVP cases. The issue is raising your hand when you are asked if you agree with another juror, a response or a disclosure in voir dire. And we seem to have taken very opposite positions on that issue. But in this case, the record was clear that a juror raised her hand and made several disqualifying statements about her ability to be fair, demonstrating she had formed a generalized opinion about sex offenders, that someone would have to be mentally ill in order to do something to a child, like happens in this case. She had already made a decision about my client's mental status by saying, "I mean, it's there," in reference to his mental abnormality. She had made a decision about the outcome of the case, saying she does not care whether he's committed or he's in jail. He needs to be in one or the other, but not released. And she couldn't use her vote to release Mr. Brady in the event the state didn't meet its burden of proof. "I mean, I can't. I just can't. I mean, that would be, like, just crazy to vote to release him." The follow-up question was, "Does anyone else agree?" And number 4 raised his hand. It is true there were no additional follow-up questions asked of number 4, but in this case, his representation that he agreed with number 19 was sufficiently clear by the record.
I believe opposing counsel says there were other questions that were asked that this juror 4 did not raise their hand or say anything to that were inconsistent with, if we were to interpret his raising of his hand to mean he agreed with all the statements made by the one juror who was stricken, then he should have raised his hand in response to these other questions and did not. Wouldn't that raise a factual issue that needed to be explored by counsel below and was not?
I think the best course of action would have been to do that, but the problem is, in that situation, the critical question is always whether this challenge veneer person indicated unequivocally his ability to fairly and impartially evaluate.
And it's the unequivocally, because if he didn't answer the other ones, isn't that something? Maybe he could put aside his prejudice, maybe he was answering one part, or maybe he was agreeing with everything, but we don't know.
Correct. And since we don't know, there was no unequivocal assurance that he could be fair and impartial, and that those views would not affect his ability to listen to the evidence and decide the case. And so the best course of action.
You don't think the burden was on defense counsel at that point to follow that up? You think
it was on? Counsel should have followed it up, and that would be another example of ineffective assistance of counsel, but ultimately the trial court is responsible for ensuring that jurors are qualified who serve on the actual panel. And in that situation, if we believe that it was equivocal and we're not sure, then it was incumbent upon the judge to ask further questions where that juror wasn't rehabilitated. And absent doing so, it would undercut any discretion he had in ruling on a motion to strike under cases like Joy and the others that were cited in my brief.
My concern with this issue is that the juror that was struck for cause, juror 19, is that correct?
Yeah.
Juror 19, I mean, never, I don't know if that juror could be fair and impartial, but never said that couldn't be fair and impartial. So it would be one thing if juror 19, if the question was, is there anyone here that couldn't be fair and impartial in this case? And if juror 19 raised her hand and said, I could not be, and then juror 4 said, and then the question was asked, does anyone agree with juror 19? And then that'd be a different, then it's unequivocal, because that's exactly what they agreed on that specific issue. It's hard from this interaction to get a sense of what exactly juror 4 may agree with or may not have agreed with.
Sure. I think it's important to look at the language of 494-470, which states in part that no person who has formed or expressed an opinion concerning any material fact or matter in controversy in the case shall be sworn as a juror. And so whether or not she said, I can be fair and impartial, she certainly expressed possible prejudice, and she certainly expressed that she has an opinion concerning the matter and material facts that are in controversy, like a mental abnormality. Are you mentally ill if you have committed an offense against a child? And about the outcome of the case. And so I think it's important we look at all provisions of the statute about juror qualification and not just the thing that we as attorneys like to say, can you be fair and impartial? Being fair and impartial doesn't necessarily mean I can say the words being fair and impartial. It means I don't have these set opinions and beliefs that are going to preclude me from evaluating the evidence, perhaps in the manner someone who doesn't have those beliefs and opinion would look at it. And I'm not expressing how I would use my vote. By the way that the voir dire was conducted in this case, someone could believe that they're fair and impartial just because they waited until the end to announce, okay, I'm ready to commit this guy, even though they believed before the evidence was presented that they were going to do that anyway. And I wouldn't think that's a fair and impartial juror, even though the instructions say, listen to all of the evidence and wait to make up your mind until the end. If you are not going to listen to all of the evidence because of a belief that you have, and if you already have decided what you think about this person in their mental health and where they belong prior to the introduction of any evidence, are you really being fair and impartial and fulfilling your duty under the statute and the Constitution when you're a juror? If there are no other questions, I will turn it over to Mr. Warren.
May it please the court. I think Judge Powell actually had a good point about what was actually said by Juror 19. And I went back through the transcripts, and frankly, I don't think that Juror 19 said anything that was technically strikeable for cause. Certainly, I agreed to strike her because of the tenor of her comments, because I was erring on the side of caution. But really, when you break down the actual words, I don't think there was a strike for cause there. So even if Juror 4, the juror in question, had agreed with everything she said, I'm still not sure that there would be a claim here. But this raises the issue of a lack of a record here. Trial counsel's responsibility, certainly not the trial court's responsibility to follow.
Well, there are cases that say where it's equivocal, the court has an obligation to ask additional questions to clarify.
Yes, absolutely.
And opposing counsel saying those are the ones that are applicable here.
And they're not, because there was no equivocation, because Juror 4 never said anything.
And we have many cases, so you're saying raising your hand means nothing, or it means something?
Well, if you look at the case that Mr. Brady has cited about whether raising your hand is enough, it actually flows the opposite way. In that case, it was whether you disclosed a claim and someone had filed a claim against you, and if he didn't raise his hand, he didn't disclose the claim. If he raised his hand, he disclosed the claim. Same problems there as here, where there was pretty much no record.
We have lots of cases recognizing raising hands, don't we, as meaning something? Although raising your hand after five questions may be ambiguous as to what you mean. But it means something.
It does mean something. That's the easiest way to conduct voir dire. You know, I see no hands, or please raise your hand if. But really, that's an invitation, I think, to create a further record. In and of itself, I don't think a hand raise is enough. It could be, I have to use the restroom. It could be, I disagree with everything Juror 19 said.
Don't you look at the record in context? And the context of whether he raised his hand was set right after a statement, do you agree with number 18, just give me a hand. So I don't think it means he wanted to go to the restroom.
Especially where the counsel then said, I see jurors 4 and 31 and whatever, just raise their hands in response to that question or whatever. So it seemed fairly clear it was in response to that question about whether they agreed. The question really is what that means.
And that is a problem with the lack of record developed by defense counsel. But having done voir dire myself, I have had two situations happen. One where someone raises their hand to run out of the room to use the restroom because they cannot wait, and do it during questioning. And I've also had someone raise their hand to disagree. Even when the question is, do you agree, they raise their hand to disagree. So there are different things that could have happened here. Of course, we don't know. And if you take it from the context, I understand. But we don't know because there were no questions asked. So there's no equivocation. And the case that appellant cites shows that same kind of evidentiary mess. They had to send it back, I think, two times to develop the record as to whether this person raised his hand or not. He testified he did raise his hand. Defense counsel testified he didn't raise his hand. That's the problem. This is the problem we've run into. Even if he raised his hand in response to that question, I agree with juror 19. The amount of questions and responses back and forth between counsel and juror 19 were lengthy. It was a lengthy conversation covering much terrain about whether or not she could be fair. And so because it was so long, it wasn't just one question. It wasn't just, can you be fair? I can't be fair. Is anyone else can't be fair? Agree. It was a long, long conversation. So we don't know what, if any, juror 4 agreed with during that conversation. In addition, Judge Seth raised the point that at the end, there were kind of catch-all questions asked by both attorneys. Is there anyone who feels like they can't be fair, or anyone who wants to change their answer? Is there anyone bothered by something? And he didn't raise his hand. So if not raising your hand is a commitment to an answer, he could be fair. And he did answer those questions. There was one point made by appellant about telling the jurors too much about the case. In these cases, we do talk a little bit about the respondent's history. We talk a little bit about the law, the elements, and of course, we have to do that. There's nothing improper about that. Under Chapter 494, we have to make sure that the jurors can be fair and have not decided these elements already. So, of course, we have to tell them the elements. We have to tell them the history to test whether or not they
can. You're saying that counsel had to tell them about all the different procedures that had gone through? Defense counsel had to do that?
Are we shifting from voir dire to the ineffective assistance counsel claim? Okay. During the trial, and I can distinguish from Foster and Senzel, which I believe the Western District has already done as well, where, one, no one relied on that information. None of the experts relied on it, and no one argued with it in opening or closing. Okay, so the attorneys were not talking about it extensively or trying to argue, hey, people have already found him to be dangerous, you should agree, or my experts agree. That was absolutely not the case here. And nor was there evidence about the probable cause hearing. This judge has already found him to be an SVP, you should too. That did not happen here. Those are egregious, the kind of egregious behavior that Foster and Senzel talk about. That was not the case here. This court has held that evidence about end of confinement reporter involvement or testimony is not barred, multidisciplinary team testimony is not barred. If that testimony is not barred, then of course it's okay to explain.
But this was by defense counsel. Was there any strategy that would have supported this from the defense as opposed to the prosecution point of view?
Absolutely. And that's clear from the record, actually. She has articulated her reasons. And that is to discredit Dr. Kircher, who is the end of confinement examiner in this case, by indicating that Dr. Kircher had not as many records as the Department of Mental Health examiner, so her opinion held less water. That she had a different standard. She was relying on a probable cause standard rather than a clear and convincing evidence standard. So that was also articulated. So a lot of that was trying to draw the sting or trying to impeach Dr. Kircher throughout, trying to explain the pretrial proceedings and essentially argue that the state shouldn't have called her as a witness. And that is on the record. And I'd like to return to ineffective assistance of counsel for a moment. There is no constitutional right here. There's no due process right here. Due process has already been protected. This court has already found substantive due process is met under strict scrutiny. Procedural due process is extensive. I understand there's a liberty issue at stake here, a liberty interest at stake, but the protections already put in place by the legislature are extensive, and the state follows them. And one of them is that a lawyer is appointed. And so this court should not extend the legislature's wishes by imputing a right that doesn't already exist there. As far as statutory issues, there is a statutory right to counsel, but that does not mean there's a constitutional right to counsel, and it does not mean there's a statutory right to effective assistance of counsel. And I think Tennessee in In re Carrington actually brought up a good point about especially in TPR cases, where states are very all over the board about TPR cases, that we shouldn't go ahead and do something the legislature hasn't already done, and actually criticize this state for adopting TPR cases as being the standard that it is. And so, because there's no statutory right to effective assistance of counsel, I think this court should not go down that road. If it were, there's a panoply of issues about proper venues. But one thing is for certain, and that this is not the right venue. This is not the right case. Habeas case would have been perhaps more appropriate. I understand that if there's no venue, it's difficult to raise it in the first instance. But this is not the appropriate case, particularly since there was no ineffective assistance of counsel here. For the reasons we've talked about during Brady's trial, there was no ineffective assistance of counsel during Grotto's case, the earlier case, which was a lot about bad acts evidence, Sonic the Hedgehog anthropomorphic video game, whether that was appropriate or not. These are not the right issues to take this case up on. And if there are no further questions, I will have a seat.
Not only has this court already announced that there is a due process right to counsel, it's very clear from precedent from the United States Supreme Court that where the state has created a liberty interest, that must comport with due process. So that's under cases like Vitek and Evitz versus Lucy, where the state has given a statutory right to counsel here, and Ms. Dolan has said that's one of the many rights provided required of procedural due process. Then that right must comport with the due process clause, and Mr. Brady and Nicholas must both be entitled to effective assistance of counsel. I think our legislature does intend for attorneys in SVP cases to be held to the same standards as criminal defense attorneys, as evidenced by the fact that Chapter 600.042 sub 4 also authorizes, it directs the public defender system shall represent anyone who's indigent in SVP proceedings. Every other individual who is eligible for public defender representation under that chapter is provided with an attorney. This court has said that Section 600.042 sub 4 means that appointed counsel must provide effective assistance of counsel, both in Pratt and in Waters. And all of the other attorneys who would handle cases under that 600 statute are evaluated under Strickland. With respect to juror number four, it is true that both attorneys, I think, asked some questions at the end of their voir dire, some general catch-all questions. Does anybody think they can't be fair and impartial? Is there anything else? The same folks who got struck for cause didn't raise their hands again to answer those questions. It was clear and it was understood that that was a question for anyone else who had not responded already, who had not already expressed a disqualifying view or opinion. We do have to look at this in context. We have to look at the answers and voir dire in context, and we also have to look at the right to counsel in context. This is indefinite civil commitment that could last someone's lifetime and be subjected to forced involuntary treatment while they're there. The right to counsel has to matter. It has to matter from the moment it's appointed in voir dire through appeal, and we have to decide how we're going to ensure that matters and how we're going to judge an effective assistance of counsel.
Could you address the Turner v. Rogers case, the Supreme Court case? The state argues it clarifies there is no constitutional right to counsel.
So that was a civil contempt case, and the United States Supreme Court did say the Due Process Clause did not require the appointment of counsel at the father's contempt proceedings to enforce the child support order. It said due process does not automatically require provision of counsel at civil contempt proceedings, but it was in certain situations. And in that case, it was where the opposing parent or the custodian was not represented by counsel. So the opposing party wasn't represented by the state at all, and then the opposing party didn't have counsel, and there were alternative safeguards. However, it declined to address when the government was the opposing party, and I think that's significant. Cases that have relied on Turner include some of the SVP cases that are cited on my brief to highlight the differences, the liberty interests at stake. This isn't potentially just 1 year. My clients can't be free from confinement if they'll just pay some money, like in a civil contempt case for non-payment of child support. It's their entire life that they're going to have this stigma. The label can never be lifted, even if they get an unconditional physical release from custody. They're always an SVP. And so civil contempt is different than criminal cases. It's different than SVP, but I think it illustrates that when the prosecutorial power of the government is being thrust upon someone, that's when we need to look at how significant the right to counsel is in those cases. And it did reaffirm Lassiter, which stated the presumption is an indigent litigant has the right to appointed counsel when, if he loses, he may be deprived of liberty.
Chief Justice, I have one more question. Could you just very briefly, since we're past time, opposing counsel says, in fact, there was no ineffective assistance here, so even if we got to that issue.
Yes. I disagree. I think the facts of this case are more egregious than Foster or Stinzel. I think we touch on both of them. I don't think there was a reasonable trial strategy in presenting essentially the entire screening process. There was testimony that an end-of-confinement evaluator testifies at a probable cause hearing. There was testimony that there is then a determination by the court whether the person should be held and have a full evaluation. There was testimony that the court, at that outcome of that hearing, holds an individual order over and orders a full evaluation, and that in this case, the court held Mr. Brady over and ordered Dr. Scott to do an evaluation. Whether or not counsel stood up and said we have experts who relied on the screening process, I think those are relevant. I think when we lay out every step of the process, from the very small number of people who are screened in, 3 to 5%, to every person who reviews it, that it proceeds to the next step, they review, there is a court's determination at a probable cause hearing, and all of these things happen in this case, it's to highlight for the jury whether or not we expressly say a court has already determined there was enough to hold this guy and get a full evaluation. Jurors are credited with reasonable intelligence, and they're able to draw that conclusion reasonably. There was no need to do that, even if the intent was to impeach Dr. Kircher or discredit her. It simply could have been asked, are you aware if you reviewed more records than Dr. Kircher? Dr. Scott knew the answer to that. The answer was yes. There was no reason to talk about the screening process. And the fact that it was introduced and brought out by defense counsel is particularly prejudicial. That defense counsel brought out evidence that a jury would rely on in making their determination that was harmful to the client has to be an effective assistance of counsel.
Thank you, counsel.